Hello again, and welcome to this edition of My Car Guru. This is Lenny Lawson. I'm a 44-year veteran of the auto industry. Most of that has been a lot of fun, but some of it sucked, and that's just the way it goes. But I guess every business has that aspect of it. You know, there's parts that are fun and parts that aren't. I guess the parts that suck the most are when cars aren't selling. People aren't buying, you know. We've been through some terrible recessions back in the early 70s, the gas crisis, early 80s when prime interest rate was 18%. See, young folks they can't comprehend that. You know, you talk about the Fed getting aggressive to fight inflation. That's aggressive. This is not. So, you know, you have your ups and downs as far as the economy is concerned. And then you have, you know, the aspects of a business where you have to deal with people who just don't trust you, don't like you. I wonder if other industries really have to deal with that. Maybe lawyers. I don't know if you call that an industry or not. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those jobs where you are untrusted from the get-go because you're trying to sell somebody something and you're a car dealer. And those, they're not really looked on highly and for a lot of good reasons. You know, I talk about them on this radio show all the time. The things that get car buyers in trouble and the misbehaving, you know, that occasionally goes on. So hopefully I've given you enough clues to look for. You know, the biggest one is the how much you want your payment to be. You know, that's one of the big ones that I have a serious problem with. But anyway, I'm here to make your car life better. I can't do anything about the rest of your life. But, you know, if your car's going good, your transportation is reliable, you don't pay too much for it. When you go trade it, you don't get burned. Then, you know, you can enjoy the freedom that we have in this country to move around. My wife and I are moving around some this weekend. We're going to be pulling the camper to Pigeon Forge and setting up. I think the weather on Friday is none too good, but that's okay. We can have a good time down there. Just going in and out of places and going to the outlets and just sitting in the camper and reading a good book. So that's very likely to be occurring this weekend. But yeah, we're going to take an extra car. It will probably be either the Miata or my Porsche and drive it through the mountains. We're going to go maybe go over to Fontana Village and check that out. Go over to the Dragon. You ever heard of the Dragon? I don't know how many curves in this road, but it's supposed to be a blast to go drive it. I did it many years ago, but I just don't recall how many turns. It's hundreds of turns in this stretch of road, and people just love to go and burn it up. I won't be doing that. She restrains my driving, which should be restrained at times, especially on a busy road like that. But yeah, we're going to go exploring. Might go over to Western North Carolina and check out what is that town over there? Waynesville. Yeah, Waynesville, North Carolina. Maybe go to Cashiers. And there's just so many cool places in Western North Carolina, aren't there? I mean, if you've never come down and visited Asheville, for example, you should. You know, if you make a trip to this region and don't go and see Biltmore, you know, the house that George Vanderbilt built back in the early 1900s. There's no house like that house unless you go over to Europe. You might see some castles and so forth that are, I think it's the largest singly owned or family owned residence in the United States. Of course, the Hearst Castle out on the West Coast near San Simeon, California is pretty impressive as well, as are many of the mansions and stuff at Newport. There's so many wonderful places to go in this country, but go experience Asheville, and while you're there, go to the Grove Park Inn. That is it used to be called a sanatorium. It's not where, you know, people went where they were crazy. It's where they went when they wanted to relax, and had a beautiful golf course there, and some very famous golfers like Bobby Jones actually played on the golf course there. I've played on it, but nobody cares. It is a fun golf course, but the Grove Park Inn is definitely worth seeing and definitely worth going to the brunch at the Grove Park Inn on Sundays. It's ridiculously fantastic. So I'd recommend. I also recommend the Tobacco Antique Barn It is down there on the Swannanoa River near Biltmore, near the Biltmore House entrance. And it is a fantastic place to go if you're looking for antiques. See, you didn't think this was going to be a show about traveling around in this beautiful area that we live in, but sometimes we will delve into that that subject as well. So anyway, lots of cool places to go. Asheville is definitely one of them. Another is one of my favorites is Greenville, South Carolina. It's just a beautiful Main Street area. I don't know about the rest of Greenville, but we just go downtown and stay at the Hyatt or one of the other hotels down through there, and it's just fun. You know, it's a fun geezer trip, like me. That's what I am. Proud of it. Okay, let's get into some of the topics of the day. I do want to make sure that you are buying the best vehicle for your teen driver. That's one of the things I want to talk about today. You know, all of us as parents and sometimes grandparents who are raising our grandchildren, and that happens sometimes, happens more now than ever, we want to make sure that our kids are happy and that they have good transportation. Safe transportation is the priority. But I have some recommendations as far as that is concerned, not specific cars, so to speak. I think there's certain things that people need to look for and ignore the temptations that we have as parents to, you know, maybe reward our kids too early before they've actually earned it. I think that's important to do. I always put my kids in used cars. My dad's first car for me was a 67th Plymouth Fury. I said, Dad, how come I don't get to drive a new Chevrolet? He said, because you haven't earned it. Enjoy what you have. That'll be fine. That'll get you to high school and back. And so, and he was right, it did. And then I graduated to a Vega GT back in 1972. And so did I step forwards or backwards? Well, the Vega didn't have much power. It didn't have as much power as the Plymouth Fury, but it did look a little bit better. It didn't have a bench seat, though, so that was not as good for parking, you know, not parallel parking. You know what I'm talking about. Not many cars have bench seats anymore. Have you noticed? So let's talk about what kind of car you should have for your young driver. Resist temptation to buy them something new. But always buy them something safe. You should always consider the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety crash ratings. Now, if you look at this, let's say you're shopping for a new car and you look at the window sticker, it has stars there, and it tells the different types of accidents that you could have in this car and what the safety rating is for that particular accident, like for rollover, side impact protection, direct frontal impact. You know, these are things, the test that the Insurance Institute does. You've seen them on TV, but you always look at those ratings. You want to buy something at least 4 stars or higher for your young driver. Also, think about center of gravity and wheelbase. You know, the lower the center of gravity, the easier it is to control that car. And when I say car, I think cars make the best first vehicles for your kids, not Jeeps, you know, not some lifted F-150. I know that's what they want, but that's not what they should have as their first vehicle. I've also said that they should be just a little bit ashamed of what you're putting them in. I know your kid got straight A's and all that stuff, and now he's a good driver, and you've always promised him this, but that's okay. You can back up a little bit, and you say, okay, this is your test. This is the test car to see how you do with responsible driving. And if you do well with this, then we will consider getting the vehicle of your dreams. But it's still not going to be a Jeep, a Wrangler, I should say. Could be a Jeep, you know. It could be a, I don't know, Renegade or something like that. As long as we're looking for low center of gravity, I would recommend like a Honda Accord, a Toyota Camry, maybe a Ford Fusion, Hyundai Sonata, Mazda 6. You know, these are mid-size cars. You know, they're not mid-size compared to the mid-size cars when I grew up, you know, driving Malibus and Cutlasses and stuff like that. Much smaller, but safer in many ways. These cars typically do really well in all of the crash tests. Don't worry so much about miles. You know, if you're buying something older, one of the first things to find out is, does this thing have a replaceable timing belt? And a lot of cars do. The timing belts are supposed to be changed on most vehicles at either 60,000 miles or 100,000 miles. And you know, if a timing belt breaks on one of these four-cylinder engines, then you've got pistons running into valves and it destroys the engine. So, you know, look at the maintenance records on these vehicles. Look at the reviews on these vehicles and find out what kind of experiences are they having. But these cars are safer. They can control the cars better. Accident avoidance is so important. And, you know, drive with your young drivers. Let them drive, you know, while they're getting their learner's permit after they get their learner's permit and they're 16. Put them on the road. I remember the first time my mom said, okay, we're going to Knoxville. I said, can I drive? Yes, you can. And it was in her, I think it was probably a 1972 Chevrolet Caprice. It was a four-door. And we're going down the interstate, and she, you know, made me drive like 5 or 10 miles an hour below the speed limit. But I remember how hard a time I had just keeping the car on, you know, between the lines. It wasn't because I wasn't focused. It was just because it was such a big car. And, you know, the tires back then weren't as good as they are now. And I was, you know, really had to concentrate. Of course, as you get used to driving a car, you know, those moves with the steering wheel and so forth become kind of, I don't know, second nature, and you don't have to think about it. But you want to get them as much driving experience in real-world conditions as possible. Also, I think in the state of Tennessee, we have laws that regulate how many passengers can be in a car. Make sure they're staying with that. And for goodness sake, track where they go. There's all kinds of really cool devices that you can buy. You can plug it in the OBD2 port that's underneath the dash, and it will actually give you telemetry on how fast they were driving. Ford actually sells some cars that has something called a smart key, and you can program whenever that key is used, the car will go no faster than 65 miles an hour. That's not a bad idea, especially for a young male driver. I know some females will drive fast as well, but you can get a lot of information. Also, on their cell phone, you need to be able to track them. Who pays for the cell phone? That's right. You do. And so you have total authority of what's on that cell phone and what they're allowed to see and do and so forth. I think a lot of parents have just kind of said, I can't control that. But you can. You just don't want to. So let's talk about size as far as vehicles. You know, I'm not afraid of a Honda Civic or a Mazda 3 or, you know, a Hyundai Elantra. Those are pretty small cars, but they do have good ratings. But I really do like midsize cars better for first drivers. You know, I mean, people used to think that it was better to buy them, surround them with as much metal as possible. So like a 1982 Mercury Marquis. Well, all that metal doesn't really make them that much safer. It can, but if they're not wearing their seat belts, then they just become human projectiles, and that is not a good thing. It's better to have a car that is going to give seat belt warnings. It has the latest airbag technology, and better yet is the collision avoidance technology that is available on most 21 models or newer. So 21 and 22s. I know maybe you can't afford a car like that, and I get it. If you can't, then buy as new as a car as you can with the best crash ratings. Let's see what else. Well, we got car tech, first driver, make them earn it, center of gravity will be. I think I've covered just about every concern that I have. Do you have any? If you have any questions about a specific car, then feel free to let me know about it. 423-552-2020, and I'll answer your questions and give you some guidance on that. A lot of people want to buy their kids little small SUVs, you know, like Honda CRVs and Toyota RAV4s, and they're okay. They're fine. You know, they're basically built on a car platform. But, you know, try to stay away from anything that's jacked up that has a real high center of gravity. You know, a kid's going down the road and they're not paying attention, and maybe they go off the edge of the road and jerk the steering wheel and the car rolls over. Well, if you're driving a car that's probably year 2000 or newer, I know that's pretty old, that's 22 years ago, then it's probably going to have dynamic stability control. You can thank the Ford Motor Company for that. You remember when Ford Explorers were rolling over and Firestone tires were popping like firecrackers, especially in the hot Florida sun? Well, That's when the government decided, okay, we've got to do something about this. And they used anti-lock brake technology to develop dynamic stability control. And it uses a little bit of throttle. The computer is making decisions for the driver. It uses a little bit of throttle. It uses a little bit of braking pressure on the correct wheel. And it keeps the car from rolling over under many circumstances. So you want to make sure that the car that your kid is driving has that. Okay, I'm going to take my first break. I'll be back here in just a second. Okay, I'm back. I was talking to a customer the other day on the lot, and he was asking me about the Ford Explorer. And he said, I heard that the Ford Explorer, which used to be front-wheel drive, is now rear-wheel drive. And I said, sir, you are correct. He said, well, does that affect the, you know, the performance in terms of driving in bad weather, like snow and ice and so forth? And I said, no, it does not, because the Ford Explorer is an all-wheel drive vehicle. He said, well, what does that mean? I thought it was rear-wheel drive. No, you can get them in just rear-wheel drive, which would be considered a two-wheel drive vehicle. But no, the Ford Explorer is all-wheel drive. And so what it does is it senses slippage. So if your rear wheels start to spin, then the front wheels will automatically engage. And now you can change, the Explorer does have a dial where you can change from, you know, ice to snow to mud and so forth. I don't know why they bother to put that on there. It's just a gimmick. But, you know, Toyota does it and Nissan does it. You know, you don't need to change the mode. If you have to change the mode, I mean, how many people actually go through the desert or really go off-road in their soccer mom SUV? None. You know, I never see them with mud splashed all over them. It's always, you know, some old beater truck or a Jeep or something like that. Those are the ones that go off into the boonies. You've seen them. You know, their car is, or their SUV, Jeep, whatever, is completely covered with mud. They put it on the trailer or they drive it around that way because they want to, I don't know, what's the message? I like to go mudding. Maybe. So they'll do that. They'll drive around for about a week, and then they'll get tired of their nasty vehicle, and then they'll take it to the car wash. But you don't see the soccer moms doing that with their SUVs. Yet all the TV commercials that you see shows the Ford Explorer driving through the desert or over a mountain. And, you know, it's places. I guess it's just knowing that it has that capability. Don't kid yourself. So from definition standpoint, what is a 4x4 then? Is an all-wheel drive vehicle a 4x4? Well, not by definition, no. Even though all four wheels can engage, again, it's not your decision. The car makes that decision. If it's a true four-wheel drive or a 4x4, then you can make the you have to make the decision to put it in four-wheel drive. A modern example would be a Chevy Silverado pickup truck. If it has four-wheel drive, then it's running in two-wheel drive all the time. The rear wheels are providing the motion, and the front wheels are just providing the steering and the braking. You have to make the decision. I'm going to turn this dial. I'm going to put it in four-wheel drive. And so it goes into four-wheel drive when you turn the dial. It sends power through the transfer case to the front wheels, and then all four wheels are going. Now, if you put it in automatic four-wheel drive, that's another feature of a lot of vehicles. It says auto or auto 4x4, then it's going to be in two-wheel drive until the car just makes the decision again. So you've empowered the car to decide whether it goes into four-wheel drive or not. So the four-wheel drive vehicle that I'm talking about has either a lever in the floor or it has a dial on the dash. My F-150 has a dial on the dash, and I rarely use it. I mean, if I'm pulling my trailer up a very steep hill and I start spinning, then I'll kick it in four-wheel drive. Or if I'm out in a field pulling a trailer or something like that, then sometimes you'll lose traction. It's nice to be able to switch it on. With all-wheel drive, again, you don't have to switch it on. Now, do you remember when front-wheel drive first came out? Of course you don't, because it first came out in this country. The first front-wheel drive vehicle that came out in this country came out in 1929. That's right. It was actually a Cord. That was the name of a company. A guy named Eli Cord, C-O-R-D, developed a front-wheel drive luxury car. And they were expensive. They were on par with Packards and Lincolns and cars like that. Very modern-looking, comparatively speaking, to the other cars that it was competing against. Much more aerodynamic. But this was a successful car for rich people. So that was it, the Cord, until 36 years later, Oldsmobile came out with the Oldsmobile Toronado. And that sucker, when in 1966, was basically not only a front wheel, the first front-wheel drive car in a long time, it was a powerful front-wheel drive car. It was actually a hot rod. It had 385 horsepower, about 450 foot-pounds of torque. You could smoke those front tires. It was called the Super Rocket V8, 425 cubic inches. So it's really a muscle car, a front-wheel drive muscle car. And then later on, Buick adopted the same platform. Of course, General Motors, that's the way they did things. You know, they would, I think Buick and Oldsmobile would share technologies and share platforms. They'd make them look different. And then Cadillac got into it with the Eldorado. But that was the first car in a long time that was front-wheel drive. Now, the first front-wheel drive domestic car that I've really had any experience with was a doozy, not a Duesenberg. It was the Chevy Citation, and I'll tell you about it here in just a second. You know, I don't think Chevrolet should be proud of the Chevy Citation. It was kind of a problematic vehicle. It just didn't have a lot of things perfected. You could get a four-cylinder engine. They were mounted transversely and then had an optional V6. But whenever you put your foot on the gas with the V6, it had too much power, and they had a tremendous problem with something called torque steer. And it would almost jerk the steering wheel out of your hand and go either to the right or to the left. I think it was to the right because of the way the torque was generated. It was exciting. They had this thing called, this car called the Citation X11. It was a high-performance Chevy Citation, and they sold pretty good. It looked decent. You know, it was a car that had a hatch and, again, the front-wheel drive. So it was innovative. But front-wheel drive was not new to the market because about all the Japanese cars, like Honda and Toyota and so forth, all had front-wheel drive cars. Volkswagen had the Rabbit out at that time. So there were a lot of front-wheel drive cars. General Motors' first attempt since the Toronado was not very successful. The Citation lingered on for a while, and then they came out with the Celebrity, another winner. You know, that neither of those names survived. And then they came out with the Lumina. You know, of course, Ford wasn't much better with the Granada and the Fairmont and some of those names. So all of these, it was a front-wheel drive revolution. And the one of the primary drivers of that was not traction. It was packaging. You know, you could make the cars smaller, turn the engine sideways, and have a lot more room for the passengers and cargo. At least that's what Chevrolet told us to say to our customers, because they would say, "How front-wheel drive? I mean, why would I want that?" Because you got to keep in mind, most Chevrolet buyers didn't care about that, didn't think they did. But General Motors was losing so much business to Honda and Toyota and so forth, that they said, okay, we got to do something. So they came out with a Citation. Goodness sake. Okay. So there's a basic explanation for you of all-wheel drive and front-wheel drive and four before. And so, you know, if you go out to buy one, you need to know what its capability is. There have actually been people that they thought just because they were buying an SUV or a crossover SUV like a RAV4 or a Honda Pilot or something, they just assumed it was all-wheel drive. You know, that because it's an SUV. I've seen the commercials. Now, you better make sure, because I've seen it happen. I've seen people buy a vehicle from a dealership and thinking that it was all-wheel drive, and it was actually just a front-wheel drive vehicle. And they were sorely disappointed. Don't be sorely disappointed. Know what you're buying. Read the window sticker. Unfortunately, you may not have that good of a salesperson working for you, or they may be having a big sale, and all they care about is getting you in the car. And how much you know about it is really irrelevant to them. They just want to see you driving off with a temporary tag on the back of it. So you got to watch out for that. Well, thanks for listening to this edition of My Car Guru, and we'll see you next time.